This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett. Ow! Oh! Woo!
Twist up! I'm back!
Yes, Guy, and others listening in at KDVS, we're back, at least for today. Yay. We said a while back that we'd be taking a hiatus from regular broadcasting, which we have done. But, you know, we just miss it, and we hope you miss us. And so we think we need to put our hand in now and again to come up with some original material. And, yes, we are still sitting back and watching, you know, the rafters fall, trying to figure out what to formulate as a response, I guess you might say. That is still a work in progress, but I'm pretty sure we will get back to it before too long. And by the way, if you're interested in protesting some of what's going on right now, there is an event in San Jose this Saturday, April 5th, you may want to look into. This will give a lot of us a chance to express our displeasure with current events. So yeah, I think you may attend that, Mr. McMillan?
Maybe.
Fair enough. Now, we do have to explain to the audience that due to a bit of a mishap, Elon Musk's Dodge program, or is it Doge program, or is it D-O-G-E? Who the hell? Who knows? Who cares? Well, anyway, due to a mishap, Elon Musk tried to fire Mr. McMillan from his work here at Radio Parallax. And, well, we got that handled, but, you know, it could have been a lot worse. They're sending people to prison in El Salvador if they have tattoos, including Venezuelans with soccer tattoos, which I guess to some of our bright sparks in the government looked suspiciously like gang tattoos from a different country on a different subject. And, by the way, we can't resist the meme that we stumbled upon, which said that firing thousands of employees and closing entire divisions to save money is like taking the engine out of your car to save gas. Now, we have to confess, it is hard to keep up with what's going on out there. Donald Trump recently announced that, you know, he thinks he should run for a third term. And he believes he can make that work, in spite of the restrictions of the U.S. Constitution in that regard. He's continuing to embolden the Israeli government by his talk of going in there and just removing 2 million Palestinians from Gaza and turning it into kind of a, I guess, Trump's idea of a resort on the Mediterranean. We do hope in the future to devote some time to that that issue, because it's sort of being shunted aside at the moment in the wake of so many crazy things going on. But really, that's among the craziest. The mass killing going on in Gaza is a horror to behold. And unfortunately, that's all we're going to say about that today. We do want to note that since we last spoke to you, we had a major embarrassment to the U.S. government of Vladimir Zelensky being criticized and demeaned by J.D. Vance, who really should keep his trap shut, and President Donald J. Trump, who continues to do the bidding of Vladimir Putin. If there's anything on Putin's wish list that Trump is not fulfilling, we'd like to know what those things are, because otherwise Vlado seems to be getting his way just about every way you want to look at it. Sounding off on this recently in The Atlantic was Garry Kasparov, one of Putin's political enemies, who said, "Welcome to the Putinization of America, comrade." Noting just a month into his presidency, Donald Trump began openly embracing Vladimir Putin's wish list for Ukraine and beyond, and upending 80 years of foreign policy by aligning the U.S. with Russia and against NATO. Trump's personal affinity for the Russian president has been long apparent, particularly since Putin's intelligence services worked full-time to promote Trump in the 2016 election, with the grateful cooperation of Trump and his campaign. And by the way, if you think that's an exaggeration or incorrect, you need to do a little more homework, which we'll go into in a moment. But said Garry Kasparov, Trump's admiration for Putin has escalated into a full-blown imitation. He's threatening to annex Canada and Greenland. He's punishing disfavored news outlets and unleashing his own oligarch, Elon Musk, to undertake a Stalinist purge of the federal government so MAGA loyalists have free rein. This all evokes chilling memories of how Putin seized dictatorial authority in early 2000s Russia, which I personally witnessed. Beware, America, your democracy is in danger. To which we add, hello. Writing in Mother Jones, David Korn said Putin's investment in Trump is sure paying off. As the world can now see, their partnership is anything but a hoax. Special Counsel Robert Mueller and the Senate Intelligence Committee, then chaired by Senator Marco Rubio, now Trump's Secretary of State, documented extensive evidence of communication and cooperation in 2016 between Trump's circle and the Kremlin. Campaign Chairman Paul Manafort, who'd worked for Putin's puppets in Ukraine, shared campaign polling data with a Russian intelligence officer. Putin, investigators found, ordered the hack into Democratic Party servers, which fed damaging information to WikiLeaks that Trump gleefully exploited. Russia also launched a host of disinformation projects to help Trump in 2024. Putin wanted Trump in the White House, and now we see why. Now, I know that there are some of you out there that think that this whole Russiagate thing is some sort of hoax. Well, it's not. And to that end, we would refer you to a book by the aforementioned David Korn, also Michael Isikoff, titled Russian Roulette. The subheadline is The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. This is something you might well want to check out, dear listener, as well as Stephen J. Harper's timeline on Russiagate, which can be found on the Common Dreams website. And we look forward to having Stephen Harper back on in the months to come. Yours truly chanced into a documentary on YouTube recently talking about this excuse that is offered by some MAGA people and some on the left, that what Putin's doing and has done in Ukraine is totally justified. The reason is that, well, when the Soviet Union was falling, we supposedly promised Mikhail Gorbachev and the Russian government that we would not expand NATO to the east. This is not exactly the case. What happened was, as the communist states of Eastern Europe began floundering beyond redemption and the Berlin Wall came down, the question was what to do with East Germany. If we're going to reunify the German state, is it going to be a neutral state? Will we allow East Germany to be a part of a NATO ally, West Germany? And the Russians agreed to let it happen. The promise they were made was that NATO troops would not move into the former East Germany and thus get closer to the Russian heartland. Nothing was ever said about whether the other nations of Eastern Europe, which are independent of the U.S., might want to make their own decisions about their security arrangements. And of course, as we all know, parts of the former Soviet Union and numerous nations of Eastern Europe, which used to be called the Warsaw Pact countries, decided, well, they didn't trust the Russian bear and thought they'd be better off allied with NATO. I think it was always recognized that bringing Ukraine into NATO was going to ignite a firestorm, so I think that the authorities of NATO dragged their feet on that one. Nevertheless, as dictators will do, Putin trumped up an excuse for going in and invading Ukraine. By the way, as you may recall, he invaded Ukraine back in 2014 and took away big chunks of countryside. We don't have time to go into this on today's program, but by God, we should do so in the future. I've been very impressed at how basically Russian propaganda promoted by Vladimir Putin has really gained a toehold in the West. And inspired a lot of people to say, well, you know, we're to blame for that war. No. Anyway, moving off that topic, I do want to note that the records that Donald Trump promised would be released regarding the JFK assassination, records which should have been released in 2017, 8 years ago. Trump promised that he would release all of them unredacted. That's been our experience, that when Trump makes a blanket statement like that, you can be almost assured that it will not happen. And while it is true that something like 80,000 pages of documents have been released, it does seem that a lot of really key things we'd like to see, well, they just don't seem to be in the pile. We re-aired our interview with Jefferson Morley, who sued the CIA to get these records released some years back. And we do believe that Jeff will return to this program to update us in the near future, along with Bill Simpich, an attorney who also sued the government to get these records out according to the law.
If that still means anything.
Yeah, good point. Anyway, because I know the people that are intimately involved in this struggle, and I know what they're trying to accomplish, I have a different perspective on what I think most people are getting by reading the mainstream media, which is, in general, nothing to see here, folks. Keep on moving. You know, it's there's no smoking gun that's turning up in this. There's nothing in here that's, you know, overturning the Warren Commission report, which is a crazy statement. One thing they seem to be admitting with Jeff Morley spearheading this is getting out the news that, well, what do you know? We look at these documents and it turned out that the CIA's head of counterintelligence, James Angleton, had kept a file on Lee Harvey Oswald for 4 years before the assassination, which is, let's just say, quite a bit different from the version we heard in the Warren Report, which was that, gosh, we don't think about this guy. We just dropped the ball on this. He fell through the cracks. Yeah, sure, he was a defector, and he went to the Soviet Union and told them he was going to give them secrets, and then, you know, married a Russian woman and came back. But dang, we probably should have interviewed him. Anyway, rest assured we'll return to that topic in the future. We do want to also note the passing of Clint Hill, the only Secret Service agent on the day of the assassination that actually got off his ass to do anything. If you've ever seen the Zapruder film or the other films that were taken that included the actual murder of the president, you will know that Secret Service agent Clint Hill jumped off the running board of the left side of the follow-up vehicle and tried to get to the limo. Unfortunately, before he could get there, a fatal blow was struck. But one part that never gets talked about regarding Clint Hill is the fact that there were 8 Secret Service agents in the follow-up vehicle, which was trailing the presidential limo by like 5 feet. Clint Hill was assigned to protect the First Lady and did his best to do so. Anyway, poor Agent Hill was troubled for the rest of his life about the fact that if he'd just been a second or maybe 2 seconds earlier, he might have been able to, in his mind, absorb the bullet that killed the president. The truth is, however, that the fatal shot that struck JFK came from the right front. And even if he'd gotten right behind the president, Clint Hill would not have made a difference. But you do have to wonder about the guy that was supposedly assigned to guard JFK, who was on the right running board of the follow-up vehicle. His name was Jack Reedy. When the shots rang out, Reedy can be seen in photographs looking around, but he makes no effort to jump off the running board, as did Clint Hill, and run to the limousine. And the question that was never asked of Mr. Reedy was, why not?
Maybe he didn't want to get shot.
Yeah, maybe not. And speaking of Kennedys, we could at this point take a dive into JFK's nitwit nephew, RFK Jr., currently the Secretary of Health and Human Services of the federal government of the United States. As a measles outbreak began in Oklahoma and Texas is now spreading across the country, RFK Jr. has not come forward to suggest that, you know, a way to combat this is to get kids vaccinated with the MMR shot. Instead, he suggested that cod liver oil could act as a really good treatment for the disease of measles. And in fact, some kids have now turned up in the hospital with vitamin A overdoses from the cod liver oil they were swilling. He's apparently also suggested that, you know, one way to combat measles might be to cook our French fries in beef tallow instead of using vegetable oil. Anyway, rest assured we'll have more to say about this madman in the future. And you know, Ms. Whelan, there's so much bad stuff floating around. I think we should take a kind of a whimsical dive back into one of our perennial favorites, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Let's start with the fact that it was a good week a few weeks back for Second Acts, with the news that former President Joe Biden, age 82, signed with Creative Artists Agency, the top Hollywood talent management firm, which counts Brad Pitt among its clients, to represent him in future endeavors. Said CAA co-chair Richard Lovett, "We are profoundly honored." It was, on the other hand, a bad week some weeks back for starving artists, with the news that Hunter Biden revealed that demand for his paintings has cratered since his father left the White House. In the 2 or 3 years prior to December 2023, I sold 27 pieces of art at an average price of $54,000, said Biden. Since then, I've only sold one piece of art for $36,000. Can you imagine that, Mr. Millen? Trying to get by on only $36,000 per painting?
Hard to do.
And it was an ugly week recently for literacy. After a religious painting bearing the commandment, "Thou shalt not steal," was stolen from a church in England, said church warden Basil Harwood, "Obviously, it doesn't make you feel good." And you know, let's do a second round.
Why not?
It was apparently a good week for election coups. Recently, after Robert Ehrlich, described as the multi-millionaire inventor of the Pirate's Booty Puffed Corn Snack, which I'm not familiar with.
I'm familiar with them.
Are they any good?
They're edible.
Anyway, the inventor of Pirate's Booty tried to declare himself the mayor of Seacliff, New York, despite losing the village's election in a 1,064-62 landslide. Ehrlich insisted the election was rigged, citing personal knowledge that several of his own supporters voted at least three times. Attention, Steve Bannon, you need to get this guy on your team. Meanwhile, it was a bad week a few weeks back for, I guess you'd say, marketing? Or is it rebranding? Or maybe it's DEI? I'm not sure. But here's the story. Officials in Florida's Miami-Dade County are considering a bill that would rename two dozen streets with the titles of local rap anthems. Commissioner Keon Hardiman, the bill's sponsor, says names like Grind With Me Terrace will boost tourism. Well, sure.
I'd go.
While at the same time honoring local music heroes. Commissioner Danielle Cohen Higgins, however, said the plan could hurt property values, adding, "I don't want Back That Ass Up Boulevard anywhere in Miami-Dade." And it recently was an ugly week for technological advancements. You'll have to bear with me on this one because it's a little complicated. And it was recently an ugly week, we'd have to say, for technological advancements. And stay with me on this one. Evidently, Oklahoma lawmakers are again considering proposals to soften the state's penalty for cockfighting. Since a 2002 ballot initiative made the blood sport a felony, there have been periodic efforts to decriminalize it, with defenders insisting cockfighting is part of Oklahoma's rural heritage. Taking a fresh approach, a new bill from GOP State Representative Justin Humphrey would lower the penalty to a misdemeanor. And here's the part I like the best. And allow cockfighting between a live fowl and a robot.
Like it.
Now, I'm not clear whether the robot would be an imitation rooster, and frankly, I don't care to research it. Okay, Donald Trump claimed. And finally, one last item that I guess is good or bad or ugly, depending upon how you want to look at it, but supposedly Donald Trump, according to Donald Trump, claimed to have won his annual golf championship at his club in Palm Beach, Florida. Trump wrote on social media, "Such a great honor, such fun." Now, Mr. Whelan and I are not golfers ourselves, but we do note that when we first started covering Donald Trump back in 2016, that a golf pro came forward and somewhat amusingly told the tale of how it was that Donald Trump openly cheats at golf.
Surprise, surprise.
Of course, that did raise the question, why would Trump behave differently in golf as regards everything else that he does?
And with all the time he spends golfing instead of working, he's probably getting better.
Yeah, we should look into how much money it is that is spent by the federal government so that Donald Trump can golf. I know it's a considerable sum, but something for another day. Here's a miscellaneous item we can't quite wrap our heads around. Apparently, last January, the Justice Department announced that it was going to deliver the final payment to the victims of Bernie Madoff. The Madoff Victim Fund will distribute, well, this is last January, was to distribute more than $131 million in its 10th and final round of payments, bringing the total amount of compensation among 41,000 victims to $4.3 billion, which shocks me. They got $4.3 billion recovered out of Bernie Madoff's machinations. But it's reported that the DOJ's fund and recovery work by trustee Irving Picard got 94% of the proven losses since the Ponzi scheme unraveled back in 2008. So, hey, Elon, looks like the DOJ does do something. Now, I do want to note, and no doubt should have noted at the very top of the program, that in our second segment today, we're going to take to the heavens and re-air a 2007 broadcast we conducted with astronomer Alan Hirschfeld. We stumbled upon Dr. Hirschfeld's 2001 book back in 2007 and thought, well, we've got to bring on a guy that wrote a book about parallax. So we did, which we will re-air for your listening pleasure after a break. I'm also going to include a little look back 100 years at the work of Edwin Hubble, he of the telescope. Yes, they named the Hubble telescope after Edwin Hubble, oddly enough. Hubble made a remarkable discovery 100 years ago that changed how we look at the universe. That's going to be a fun one, which we will tack on to our discussion with Alan Hirschfeld. And we've got a big miscellaneous file here that I think I'm going to grab from items that are, well, as miscellaneous as you want to get. Here's a list of things that you can reliably find in movies that we were quite amused by, starting with: should you wish to pass yourself off as a German officer, it will not be necessary to speak the language. A German accent will do. How about, if staying in a haunted house, women should investigate any strange noises wearing their most revealing underwear? And of course, you know, it's true that trucks and cars that crash will almost always burst into flames. And the ventilation system of any building is a perfect hiding place. No one will ever think of looking for you in there, and you can travel to any other part of the building without difficulty. Here's one I really like. If you decide to start dancing in the street, everyone you bump into will know all the steps. And finally, it does not matter if you're heavily outnumbered in a fight involving martial arts. Your enemies will wait patiently to attack you one by one by dancing around in a threatening manner until you've knocked out their predecessor. Oh, ho, ho, ho. Here's three random quotes we like. The first, from Marcus Aurelius, one of the good Roman emperors, who said, "The opinion of 10,000 men is of no value if none of them knows anything about the subject." Imagine predicting MAGA in the first century AD. Closer to the present, in the 1700s, Benjamin Franklin said, "If everyone is thinking alike, then no one is thinking." And closer to the present, Harry S. Truman once said, "My choice early in life was either to be a piano player in a whorehouse or a politician. And to tell the truth, there's hardly any difference." Now, New Scientist magazine publishes a column pretty much every week by James Wong, who's a botanist and science writer with a particular interest in food. One of his columns from February really kind of whipped me upside the head. It addressed the issue of whether aspirin was beneficial to plants. Wong took a look into the matter and decided that, well, aspirin, or acetylsalicylic acid, well, it's made by plants for a reason. And if you dissolve an aspirin tablet in water and spread it over your plants, it tends to induce what the plant equivalent of an immune response is. It's alleged that it can also even improve the quality of the harvests of plants in your yard. But ironically, the thing that everybody has heard of, that you can put an aspirin tablet in a vase and it'll keep your plants going longer, apparently is not substantiated. Wong suggests that you just stick to using pure tap water for flowers like chrysanthemums and roses, etc. If you do try to water your plants with aspirin in your home garden, let us know how that pans out. Drop us a line at info@radioparallax.com. And how about this question that was posed to the Old Farmer's Almanac in last year's edition? The question was, did Native Americans have cats and dogs before the arrival of European colonizers? And the answer is that domestic cats did not exist in the Americas before Europeans arrived. However, there was a diverse range of dogs. They think that humans brought dogs from Eurasia at least 15,000 years ago, and the dogs traveled with humans who selectively bred them for many different purposes. For example, the Coast Salish indigenous people of the Pacific Northwest bred a unique long-haired dog for its wool. They evidently sheared or combed out hair from these woolly dogs and wove it into intricate textiles for regalia, blankets, and rugs. And no, we have no way of knowing whether when those rugs got wet, they smelled like a wet dog. We just don't know.
Hopefully not.
And if you were watching television back in the 1960s, and we know that some of you no doubt were, you may remember the Ranger probes that were crashed into the moon. Turns out that it was on March 24th in 1965, just 60 plus years ago now, that the last Ranger was crashed into the moon. And I don't know, it was quite dramatic watching this unfold. If you're a little kid like I was, watching this probe, knowing it was going to hit the moon at a very high rate of speed. This was not a soft landing. This was referred to as a hard landing. Anyway, the Rangers and their hard landings were a success, and the surveyors and their soft landings were a success. And as we all know, the Apollo program was a success in putting people on the moon before the end of the decade. All right, in the 1 minute it looks like we have left, I want to pull up something that was sent to me by a cousin, titled The Real Luxuries in Life. Time, health, a quiet mind, slow mornings, ability to travel, rest without guilt, a good night's sleep, calm and, quote, boring, unquote, days, meaningful conversations, home-cooked meals, people you love, and people who love you back. I'd have to say, damn, those are the luxuries in life. All right, let's take a short break and come back and do some astronomy. I'm Douglas Everett. This is Radio Parallax.